Ready to roll into savings? Visit Dave Gill Chevrolet at 4700 East Broad Street in Columbus, your hometown Chevy experts. Right now, take advantage of tariff-busting deals on some of our most popular models. Experience the bold new 2025 Silverado 1500 with its powerful V8 engine and cutting-edge tech. Or discover the all-electric 2025 Chevy Equinox EV for an eco-friendly commute without compromising style or range. Looking for value? Browse our extensive inventory of certified pre-owned vehicles. From sporty coupes to family-friendly SUVs, each rigorously inspected for your peace of mind. Cruise over to Dave Gill Chevrolet or visit us online today at DaveGillChevy.com and drive home happy.
This case is a bit different from the usual ones we cover. It's not from Florida, where there seems to be a wild story every week. This one takes us far away, back to my home state of Alaska. I'm transporting us back to 1991 in Fairbanks, Alaska. At the time, the population was about 31,000 people. The number of violent crimes per capita in Fairbanks was slightly above Alaska's average, but the total number of crimes was still quite low due to the small populations. For instance, there were only two murders in Fairbanks in the entire year of 1992. Our case today takes place not in the city proper, but in the woodsy, forested areas surrounding the University of Alaska Fairbanks, or UAF. As of 93, no one had been killed on the UAF campus for 20 years. The last campus murder occurred in 1972. That serene, wooded setting gave families a sense of security when sending their kids to college. It felt safer than big urban universities. But for some students at UAF, this big school in the woods was actually much larger and more urban than when they came from. Some of them arrived from tiny, remote villages scattered across the Alaskan wilderness. One such student was Sophie Sergey. Sophie was born in 1972, the same year as the last murder on campus. She was a Yupik Native American from a tiny, remote village called Pitka's Point. The community is 100% Native American and had a population of just 130 people in 2020. According to a USDA report from 2011, the water and wastewater conditions in places like Pitka Point were staggering. Drinking water had to be hauled from local points that didn't meet safe standards, and wastewater was disposed of using honey buckets. That means the same path kids walked to school were also used by people carrying buckets of raw waste to dump stations. Sophie was coming from a place of extreme isolation. Heading 500 miles east to Fairbanks to attend college was a monumental change. She was small in stature, only 4'9 or 4'11, depending on the source. Her mother's name was Alina, and Sophie had a toddler brother, Stephen, whom she helped care for. She also had an older brother serving in the Navy. Sophie originally wanted to follow in her brother's footsteps and join the Navy herself, but she was too short to qualify for the position she wanted. Instead, Sophie chose to become the first in her family to attend college. She enrolled at UAF to study marine biology. She was bright, driven, and serious about her education. Her success meant everything to her family and her village. Though she was shy, she made friends and stayed focused. She wasn't a partier by any stretch, but she did grow especially close to a fellow student named Shirley. They met through a campus program called Rural Student Services, which helps students from isolated villages adjust to campus life. With Shirley's friendship and her strong work ethic, Sophie adjusted well to college. She completed her first 2 years at UAF. But by April 1993, she had to take a leave of absence due to medical and family issues. Sophie had a severe overbite and needed major orthodontic and jaw surgery. Meanwhile, her mother had health problems of her own and needed help caring for Sophie's younger brother. The surgery Sophie needed was expensive, so she moved back home and took a job that provided health insurance. She began working at a school in nearby St. Mary's as a clerk and academic aide. Though she was on leave from school, all her medical appointments, including her surgery, still took place in Fairbanks. So she regularly flew back and forth. When she returned to Fairbanks for appointments, Sophie usually stayed with her friend Shirley at UAF instead of paying for a hotel. Her plan was to return to the school in the fall of 93, once her surgery was complete and her mother was doing better. UAF had a three-dorm complex made of Bartlett Hall, Moore Hall, and Scarland Hall. Bartlett Hall was 8 stories tall and situated between the other two. Though each hall had its own floors, they shared a common lobby and roughly 670 students lived in the complex. Back in 1993, the second floor of Bartlett Hall was reserved for female students only. Visitors of the opposite sex were allowed, but boys had to use the women's bathrooms when visiting the female floors, so seeing a guy in the women's bathroom wasn't unusual, even at night. While there hadn't been a murder on campus in 20 years, there had still been a crime. In 1991, a woman was attacked and nearly raped in a bathroom in nearby Scarland Hall, and in 1989, due to budget constraints, the university eliminated dorm security clerks. After that, people could simply follow residents through locked doors to get inside. No ID checks, no sign-ins. This lax security had consequences. In February 1993, a female student reported being raped by two basketball players while another watched. That same month, a drunk, naked man was found in the woman's bathroom at Bartlett Hall. He was arrested, but still, no real changes were made to dorm security. In April 1993, Sophie had another appointment in Fairbanks. She planned to stay at Shirley's dorm room in Bartlett Hall. Shirley now lived in room 227 on the second floor. She had a single room with no roommate and decided to give Sophie her keys for the weekend, choosing instead to stay with her boyfriend next door. On Friday, April 23, 1993, Sophie flew from Pitcairn's Point to Bethel, then to Anchorage, where she stayed the night. On Saturday, she continued on to Fairbanks. After arriving, she visited her friend Joanne Sundown, who took a photo of her. Her appointment was scheduled for Monday. On Saturday, she had lunch and hung out with Shirley before heading into town to pick up supplies that would be hard to find back home. On Sunday, Shirley had to study for finals, so Sophie made other plans. She went to a movie with friends, including Sundown, then drove to Murphy Dome to look at the Northern Lights. She didn't drink, didn't party, didn't do drugs. She just enjoyed time with her friends. That night, they dropped her off at Bartlett Hall. Later that night, Sophie, Shirley, and Shirley's boyfriend Noah ordered pizza and ate it on the dorm room floor. It was now early Monday morning, April 26th, around 1 a.m. They finished eating, and Shirley and Noah prepared to leave for his room. Sophie was going to sleep in Shirley's room. She wore a colorful, hooded, Native American-style sweater and her brother's navy sweats. Before Shirley left, Sophie asked where she could smoke a cigarette. It was too cold to go outside comfortably, and she didn't want to smoke in the room. Shirley told her to use the girls' bathroom down the hall and had vents and fans that would clear the smoke, so Sophie left to go smoke. Shirley and Noah waited a bit for her to return so they could say goodnight. She didn't come back, so they left a note on the door and walked to Noah's room. As they walked down the hall, they passed three people, two men and a woman. One of the men was a stranger to Shirley. They made eye contact, and she noted that she didn't think he lived here. She had no idea she'd never see her friend Sophie alive again. After Shirley and Noah left, Sophie never returned to the room. Though we can't know with certainty, it's assumed that she went to the second floor woman's bathroom, just as Shirley had suggested. After Shirley and Noah left, Sophie never returned to the room. Excuse me. Now, back in 1993, the lights in the bathroom could be turned off manually by anyone, even by someone just standing at the entrance. You could be in the shower and someone could come in and shut the lights off entirely. The second floor bathroom had several individual shower stalls, and one of the stalls contained a bathtub. The bathtub stall had a swinging door. It was completely separate from the rest of the stalls. Shortly after Shirley and Noah left, another girl from the same floor entered the bathroom to take a shower. She used the stall that shared a wall with the one containing the tub. While showering, she heard thumping sounds and what she described as muffled voices coming from the tub stall. But this was a college dorm, and unusual sounds didn't automatically raise alarms. No one went in to investigate the noises. By Monday morning, April 26, Sophie was scheduled to attend her orthodontic appointment in Fairbanks and then fly home. Around 8:50 a.m., Shirley returned to her dorm room after spending the night at her boyfriend's. She was immediately unsettled. The bed looked untouched. The note she'd left on the door for Sophie was still hanging in the same spot. The lights and TV were on, just as they had been when she left the night before. Shirley went to the bathroom, wondering if Sophie might be in the shower. She called out, "Sophie, are you here?" According to one source, a voice answered, "Yeah, I'm here," but no other sources ever confirmed this. Shirley assumed it was Sophie and took her own shower before heading to class. It's unclear whether that voice was Sophie or someone else. As the day went on and Shirley still hadn't heard from Sophie, her concern grew. She started asking around if anyone had seen her. Then she called the orthodontist's office and learned that Sophie had missed her appointment. That was a major red flag. Sophie had flown hundreds of miles specifically for that surgery consult. She would never miss it. Later, while Shirley was in class, she began to hear whispers, rumors that police were at Bartlett Hall. The word was spreading that a body had been found in the second floor bathroom. On Monday afternoon at approximately 2:42, a janitor was cleaning the east side bathroom on the second floor of Bartlett Hall. When they opened the swinging door to the tub stall, they discovered a girl's body lying in the bathtub, partially undressed and surrounded by blood. Janitor ran out of the bathroom screaming. It was a chilling realization. Other students had been using that bathroom all morning. They'd walked right past the stall, unaware that a dead body had been lying there the entire time. Campus police and medical staff arrived. Investigators, dorm staff, and state troopers followed. According to reports, 19 people were on the scene. Four of the lead investigator, Alaska State Trooper James McCann, even arrived. Shirley rushed back to the dorm once she heard what was happening. Police officers stopped her outside Bartlett Hall. She explained that her friend might be missing and that she'd last seen her just hours earlier. Shirley provided Sophie's ID, which was still in the dorm room. Using that ID, police confirmed the worst. The girl in the bathtub was Sophie Sergey. The investigation quickly escalated. Forensic teams scoured the dorm for evidence. They stayed on site well into the evening. Troopers canvassed the halls for witnesses, but no one reported hearing a gunshot, a scream, or any struggle. That would be puzzling until it was revealed how Sophie had died. She had been shot in the back of the head in that tub stall. There was no way no one heard it. It's hard to believe that such a violent act could take place in a shared dorm bathroom and no one would notice. The autopsy confirmed what everyone already suspected. This was a brutal homicide. Trigger warning, what follows is graphic. So if you don't want to listen, you can skip forward a couple of seconds. Sophie's body was found lying on her back in the bathtub. Her legs were together and bent to her left. Her feet touching the bottom of the tub, she was still wearing shoes and socks. Her pants and underwear had been pulled down past her knees. One side of her bra was pulled up, exposing her breast. Her face, pressed against the drain, was covered in dried blood and bore multiple stab wounds. Her hair and clothes were damp, indicating that water had been run after she was placed in the tub. Under her body, police found her cigarette lighter. Sophie had been stabbed in the face, shot in the head, and left there while students unknowingly showered and brushed their teeth just feet away. The crime was incredibly brazen and disturbing. Police questioned dozens of people. Everyone expected this case to be solved quickly. After all, it happened in a crowded dormitory. Surely someone had seen something. The university responded with horror. Flags were lowered to half-staff, a campus memorial was held, and Sophie's friend Shirley spoke, reading letters from Sophie's mother and others from her hometown. And she even said, quote, "It's important to know how much Sophie enjoyed life. Don't be bitter. We should continue to pray for the person who took Sophie away from us." The professor also shared memories of Sophie's curious mind and her love of learning. Yet despite the outpouring of grief, the police were no closer to identifying a suspect. They didn't know if the killer had been a student or a stranger who slipped inside. With no security, no ID checks, and exterior doors often propped open, anyone could enter the dorms. Unsurprisingly, fear spread among students. Calls to campus security surged. Parents and students demanded safer conditions. In response, UAF announced that campus police would increase patrols at night, but that was about it. As of April 27th, the day after the body was found, the university still hadn't installed any new security systems in Bartlett Hall. No ID checks, no bathroom locks, nothing had changed. And that lack of urgency caused more problems. Over the next 2 days, at least 60 students moved out of the dorm. Many of them would have been important witnesses or even potential suspects, but now they were gone, scattering across the state or country just as finals week began. And this made the investigation even harder. At the same time, police resources were limited. The Alaska State Troopers were understaffed, with not enough detectives available to fully investigate a case of this magnitude. Crime Stoppers offered a $20,000 reward for information, but leads were few and far between. The central challenge was this. No one had a clear motive. Sophie had no enemies, no known relationship issues, no history of conflict. There was nothing to explain why someone would want to harm her. Police followed up on everyone who might have had the opportunity to commit the crime, but it all led nowhere, and there were no cameras anywhere to help them track movements or confirm alibis. With no strong suspects, police began to believe Sophie may not have known her attacker at all. Perhaps it was at random, and that possibility was chilling. It meant anyone could have been the victim, could have been any girl who happened to enter the bathroom that night. Native American students on campus held a prayer vigil. It was the second memorial for Sophie. Around that time, the autopsy report came in, and it confirmed the most crucial piece of forensic evidence. Semen was found. The samples were preserved and sent to the Alaska State Crime Lab. But in 1993, Alaska did not yet have the DNA testing technology required to analyze it, so it sat untested, unused, just stored in a cabinet. Eventually, the university started taking baby steps to improve safety. By May 2nd, they began checking IDs at the dorm entrances and told students to lock their doors. Apparently, many students had left their dorm room doors unlocked even after the murder. Yet, despite these tiny changes, students still regularly propped open exterior doors.
Ready to roll into savings? Visit Dave Gill Chevrolet at 4700 East Broad Street in Columbus, your hometown Chevy experts. Right now, take advantage of tariff-busting deals on some of our most popular models. Experience the bold new 2025 Silverado 1500 with its powerful V8 engine and cutting-edge tech. Or discover the all-electric 2025 Chevy Equinox EV for an eco-friendly commute without compromising style or range. Looking for value? Browse our extensive inventory of certified pre-owned vehicles. From sporty coupes to family-friendly SUVs, each rigorously inspected for your peace of mind. Cruise over to Dave Gill Chevrolet or visit us online today at DaveGillChevy.com and drive home happy.
First, making it easy for anyone to sneak in. Trooper Jim McCann spoke to the media. He said they had recovered fingerprints, hair, and other physical evidence from the crime scene. They still had no suspect. He added that the killer seemed to have a deep anger toward women and likely fit in with the student population, meaning he probably wasn't an older outsider. The killer, McCann believed, was familiar with the campus and the dorm layout. Excuse me. Only 10 leads had come in by that point, a disappointingly low number. McCann warned the public that the killer might not be confined to the campus community. He could be anywhere. Despite the grim circumstances, the university tried to move forward. Commencement was held on May 9th. Students graduated. Many left campus. The investigation became harder by the day. A full year later, in April 1994, Sophie's mother, Alina, filed a lawsuit against the University of Alaska. She was seeking $4 million in damages for herself and Sophie's younger brother. Her claim was that the university had been negligent, that their poor security allowed Sophie's death to happen. But the university countered with an important question. What if the killer wasn't an intruder? What if the killer lived in the dorms? If so, was the school still responsible? That question would fuel a long back-and-forth legal battle. Sophie's mother made it clear that her lawsuit wasn't just about money. She wanted to prevent something like this from ever happening again. In the years that followed, the university did make real changes. By 1995, bathroom lights were left on 24/7. Emergency phones were installed in every student's room. Dorm entrances were restricted to one monitored door at night and on weekends. UAF also began arming its campus police officers, something they had never done before. In June 1996, 3 years after the murder, Sophie's family pushed for more transparency from law enforcement. They still had no real answers. The investigation had stalled, the state had no suspect, no arrests, and no significant updates. Sophie's mother and her legal team demanded more records from state investigators, but by then, a gag order had been placed on the case. That meant none of the involved parties could speak publicly about it. The reason? Likely to limit further damage to the university's reputation. The case had become a symbol not just of violence against Native women, but of institutional failure. The school didn't want more publicity, and so they shut down communication. Still, investigators hadn't given up. As 1996 came to a close, they decided to try something new, something experimental. They posted a description of the case online. Yes, on the World Wide Web, as it was called then. They uploaded Sophie's photo and a brief summary of her murder in hopes that someone, somewhere, might recognize similarities to another unsolved case. Sounds quaint now, but back then, oh, it was groundbreaking. Investigators believe Sophie's killer was likely a repeat offender, a rapist or murderer who had probably struck before or would again. It didn't make sense to them that someone would commit such a violent, brazen act just once. Sergeant McCann said he hoped the internet would help them reach thousands of people. He didn't like having an unsolved sexual murder on his record. In May 2000, there was real progress. New DNA testing technology allowed law enforcement to finally process the semen, a sample taken from Sophie's body. They developed a full DNA profile and entered it into CODIS, the National Criminal Database. But once again, there's no match. It was a crushing blow. If the killer had any kind of record, he'd be in the system. But he wasn't. The working theory had been that Sophie's killer was a serial predator, but this person had never been arrested, never flagged, never tracked. The trail went cold again. By 2003, despite everything investigators had done, from collecting physical evidence to processing DNA, they were no closer to finding Sophie's killer. The case faded from the headlines, but never from the hearts of those who knew her. Despite the years passing, the Alaska State Troopers refused to let the case die. In 2009, a new cold case investigator named James Stogsdill was assigned to Sophie's murder. He began by retracing the original investigation and interviewing anyone who lived in Bartlett Hall at the time. In April 2009, 16 years after the murder, the police made a public request. They wanted to know if anyone had seen Sophie standing outside Hess Commons on the night of April 25th or the early morning of the 26th. Investigators had begun to consider a new theory. Perhaps Sophie had been killed somewhere else and moved into the bathroom afterward. An independent forensic examiner suggested the idea based on an analysis of the crime scene. Though the theory can't be confirmed, it raised the possibility that someone had killed her in another part of the building and transported her body into the bathtub stall. But that raised another issue. How could someone carry a dead body into a public dorm hallway without anyone seeing them? Not only that, Sophie had chosen to stay inside because it was cold. Why would she have left the building in the middle of the night? Logistically, it didn't make sense. During this renewed investigation, Stogsdill re-examined a former student who had once been interviewed in 1993, Nicholas Dazer. Back then, he had been living in room 305 in Bartlett Hall. He had a roommate named Stephen Downs. Both had been questioned in the original investigation, but neither offered anything useful at the time. Downs claimed to have spent the night with his girlfriend, giving him an alibi. Now, in 2010, Stogsdill learned something new. Dazer had been employed as a campus security guard during the time of Sophie's murder. In fact, he had been working the very night she was killed, and he'd even helped police secure the crime scene afterwards. However, Dazer was later fired. Why? Because he had been keeping a gun, personal firearm, in his dorm room, and that was a direct violation of campus rules. When questioned again in 2010, Dazer admitted that he kept a gun in the dorm, but he denied owning a .22 caliber firearm, the same caliber that had killed Sophie. Still, when asked if he knew anyone who did have a .22, Dazer offered a name, his former roommate, Stephen Downs. He now had two names and a possible connection between Downs and the murder weapon. He continued pursuing this lead, but before he could solve the case, he retired. Once again, the case faded into the background. Another cold case investigator would need to pick it up. And that happened in 2018, when investigator Randy McFerrin was assigned the file. But by then, a revolution in crime solving had taken hold. For years, DNA in Sophie's case had sat unused, a full profile, but no matches in the criminal system. Now, investigators had another option, forensic genealogy. This new method had been turning cold cases around the country upside down. By submitting a DNA profile to open-source genealogical databases, the kind used by everyday people to build family trees, investigators could find relatives of the person they were looking for. And from there, they could build out a family tree and zero in on their suspect. This was actually the same method that led to the arrest of the Golden State Killer. The biological evidence collected from Sophie Sergey's body was sent to a company capable of running a genealogical comparison. And on October 18th, 2018, the results came back. 2 strong matches. 2nd cousins are closer, and 3 more possible matches. 3rd cousins are closer, have been identified. The information was handed over to a forensic genealogist who began constructing a family tree. And from that tree, one name emerged. The DNA led them to Stephen Downs, the same Stephen Downs who had lived in Bartlett Hall in room 305 in 1993. The same man who had once told police he was with his girlfriend that night. The only DNA found inside Sophie's body belonged to him. Now the task was to prove it. Investigators began building a case against Downs. He had been born in 1974 in Maine, graduated high school in 92, moved to Alaska for college, starting at UAF in the fall, remaining there through 96, and then later lived in Arizona before returning home. Crucially, Downs had never been arrested. Ever. No criminal record, no DNA in CODIS. Without genealogy, he never would have been identified. Law enforcement placed him under surveillance. They wiretapped his phone. He even mounted a camera on a utility pole near his home. They followed him for weeks, hoping he would discard something with his DNA. Cigarette, a coffee cup, but he didn't. Eventually, they decided to confront him. On February 13, 2019, Alaska State Troopers knocked on Downs' door in Maine. He agreed to speak with them. He claimed he didn't know Sophie Sergey. He remembered her face from old news coverage, but said he never met her. He insisted he had never been to the second floor of Bartlett Hall that night, and said he'd spent the night with his girlfriend. The next day, police executed a search warrant at his home. They also obtained a court order for a cheek swab. That DNA sample was sent for analysis, and it matched the semen taken from Sophie's body in 93. Stephen Downs was finally arrested on February 15, 2019. With Stephen Downs now under arrest, the pieces of the case began to fall into place, at least from the prosecution's perspective. Investigators had spoken with him for over 2 hours during the interview in Maine. Throughout questioning, Downs denied knowing Sophie, denied being on the second floor, and maintained his innocence. But his DNA said otherwise. Without that DNA match, there was no way this case would have gone to trial. Downs had never been arrested before. There were no eyewitnesses, no fingerprints, no one who saw him enter the bathroom with Sophie, nothing to tie him to the crime scene, except the biological evidence found inside her body. That made all the difference. After his arrest, Downs was extradited from Maine back to Alaska to face charges of first-degree murder and first-degree sexual assault. He was 44 years old at the time. In court, he pleaded not guilty. The case would take years to go to trial, in part due to the COVID-19 pandemic, which caused delays across the legal system. His trial was eventually held during the height of the pandemic, with witnesses appearing virtually, testimony streamed over screens, and everyone in the courtroom wearing masks. In 2021, while awaiting the trial's outcome, Sophie Sergey's mother passed away. She had spent decades fighting for justice for her daughter, and tragically, she never got to see the resolution she so fiercely pursued. When the trial finally moved forward, the jury began deliberating on February 7th, 2022. They deliberated for 4 days. On February 10th, they returned their verdict, guilty on both counts. First-degree rape and first-degree murder. Stephen Downs was now 47 years old and facing a mandatory prison sentence. The trial marked a historic moment for Alaska. It was the first time in state history that a criminal conviction had been secured using genealogical DNA technology. What had started as a novel approach, uploading a DNA profile to a public genealogy database, ended in a powerful result. Sophie's younger brother, Alex, expressed his relief at the verdict. He had taken nearly 30 years, but they finally had some measure of justice. In their sentencing recommendation, the prosecution called the crime brazen and said it was shocking that Downs wasn't caught sooner, and they asked for a 75-year sentence. The defense, in contrast, argued that Downs had been immature at the time, that he had been drinking heavily during college, up to a fifth of whiskey per night. It was just a lost young man. They claimed he wasn't a monster and asked the court to consider a lighter sentence, arguing that even 20 years in prison would bring him to the end of his natural life. At one point, his attorney said that Downs would never be able to hug his parents again. That remark angered the judge, and clearly, you don't want to piss off the judge. The judge actually replied, saying, quote, "Since April of 1993, Ms. Sergey hasn't been able to hug anybody. No one has been able to hug Ms. Sergey. No one ever will be, or no one ever will again. The court sentenced Stephen Downs to 75 years in prison, 67 years for the murder, plus 8 for the sexual assault. Under Alaska law, if he behaves while incarcerated, he may become eligible for release after serving one-third of the sentence, which is roughly 25 years. To this day, Downs maintains his innocence. He is appealing both his conviction and sentence. But for now, the case is closed. What remains are unanswered questions, particularly the biggest one, why? Why did Downs do this? Why Sophie? Why only once, as far as we know? There may never be answers to those questions. Some believe that the attack was sexually motivated and opportunistic. Sophie was alone, unfamiliar with the dorm's residents, and vulnerable. It's believed that after raping her, Downs killed her to keep her from telling anyone. He stabbed her, he shot her, washed her down, and left her in the tub, knowing that students would be in and out of the bathroom for hours. He left no confession, no admission, no explanation. And yet, through decades of dedication, science, and persistence, Sophie Sergey finally received justice. She is buried in Pitka's Point, a small Alaskan village where she was born, laid to rest next to her grandmother. May she rest in peace. Let me know your thoughts on this case in the comments section below. And let me know if there's anything I missed or got wrong. And of course, with that, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Patriot Food Supply. When disaster hits, whether it's a blackout, a blizzard, or God forbid, something worse, the last place you want to be is standing in a line at an empty grocery store. And that's why I trust Patriot Food Supply. America's number one emergency food kit provider. Patriot Food Supply meals are made right here in the USA. They've got a 25-year shelf life, and the kits are loaded with delicious, easy-to-make meals that can feed you and your family when things go sideways. We're talking breakfast, lunch, dinner. No more of those bland MREs. And listen, you don't prep because you're paranoid. You prep because it's smart. You lock your doors, right? Same logic. So head on over in the link in the description and check out my Patriot Supply. You can get 4 free 72-hour food kits when you order a 4-week food supply. That's real value and real peace of mind. Stay ready, stay safe. That's the Patriot way. And of course, if you want to support the channel financially, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TW. Excuse me.
Ready to roll into savings? Visit Dave Gill Chevrolet at 4700 East Broad Street in Columbus, your hometown Chevy experts. Right now, take advantage of tariff-busting deals on some of our most popular models. Experience the bold new 2025 Silverado 1500 with its powerful V8 engine and cutting-edge tech. Or discover the all-electric 2025 Chevy Equinox EV for an eco-friendly commute without compromising style or range. Looking for value? Browse our extensive inventory of certified pre-owned vehicles. From sporty coupes to family-friendly SUVs, each rigorously inspected for your peace of mind. Cruise over to Dave Gill Chevrolet or visit us online today at DaveGillChevy.com and drive home happy.